Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Shit Show with J-Bo. This is J-Bo. This is the third and final installment of J-Bo's Musical History, Part 3. In this episode, I will talk about, mostly about my band Smile Brigade. I had a few different projects, one of the main ones being me and my friend Amy, but we tackled that in another episode, so we don't need to go through that too much here. But Smile Brigade was probably the band I'm most known for, and that's not saying that much. I wouldn't say they were known. We did some touring. We definitely got some college radio play, and we had a few hardcore fans. But this is part three. If you want to go back to part one and two, please do. They're not consecutive. It's like part one was, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 episodes ago, and part two was like 4 or 5, something like that. Anyway, before I go any further, before I go back to the beginning, that band, whatever, we'll get all into it. Anyway, here's my theme song. The theme song. Welcome to the Shit Show with J-Bo. We're going to talk about my band Smile Brigade. So I'm going to ease into it. The things I remember, the fun times mostly. It was mostly good goddamn times. We had some great shows. This band started, god darn it, it ended officially about 2.5 years ago, maybe 2 years ago. 2.5 years ago, more likely. And then it started probably 9 years before that. And the strong surviving members were me and Jeremy Charbonneau. Great drummer, great guy. We were very tight for a long time. I remember having a dream about that dude, and like we were getting married. I know it's weird. A little bit. We were getting married in the dream, and like, I think right as we were going to exchange vows, I remember looking around being like, but I'm not gay. What are we doing here? You know, that was a sign of how close we were. Not that there's anything wrong with being gay, of course, you know, a little Seinfeld humor for you. So that band started out, it's kind of sprung, there was J. Hiram Boggs and Satisfaction. And at some point, Jeremy, I think, maybe, I don't know if he gave me an ultimatum. I don't think I would have gone for that. But he pushed for an actual proper band name so he wouldn't be labeled Satisfaction and it wouldn't be like my show, you know, strictly. Because we had played just me and him, you know, just as a two-piece all over, you know. I don't know. I think it was pretty good. I remember having fun doing it. Who the hell knows? I'd probably watch now and be like, Jesus, how terrible, or whatever. But as a two-piece, it was fun, but I think it got better when it got filled out a little bit. Our first show as Smile Brigade, I remember somebody was pissed that we were called Smile Brigade because I had been like Jesse Boggs for so long, or I think it was just Jesse Boggs, and my buddy Cody Fat Sacks. We were playing at, I think, the Nectar with a guy named Stan. And honestly, I forget who was on bass at that point. But somebody yelled out, Jesse Boggs! And I don't even remember that, but he told me. He was, like, mad that we changed the name, you know. And anyway, that was the first gig as Smile Brigade. It was in Fremont in Seattle. I remember it going very well, and the songs being awesome and powerful, and people being blown away at this new crop of songs, you know. And it was mostly me and Jeremy, and the whole thing was we would just surround ourselves with bass players and guitarists and We hadn't really gotten to keyboardists yet, but we were just kind of trying to solidify a band. And I really wanted to put out a record. I think we had the material. We were working on material. And I would tell people I'm going to put out a record. And they would be like, you don't even have a band. I said, well, whatever. And I think we just went through a bunch of bass players. I remember we had a guy on, I forget his name. Such a nice, they're all nice people. We had a guy named, who knows his name, but he played fretless bass. And that was a strange sound. And I remember playing Cafe Venus and Mars Bar and just having a really nice time. And these are just totally mundane. Anyway, I'll skip forward to when we get closer to, we just screwed around a lot. We had a ton of bass players, a ton of people came and tried out. Oh yeah, how we got the name Smile Brigade was Jeremy's email address was smilebrigade@yahoo.com, I think. And he had an orthodontist who had a shirt that said Smile Brigade. And I remember thinking, well, this name's kind of been part of our whole deal because that's your email address. That's what we corresponded with. So maybe we could use that as a band name. He was down with it. And I also thought it had like a Bright Eyes, like a Nirvana, like a Joy Division type name where it almost sounded like a church group or something very positive. But then, you know, we were going to be kind of dark, so we would offset that and become our own thing, you know, two different varying ideas kind of colliding and making something new. You know, the darkness with the light, the positive and the negative, the yin and the yang. Anyway, that was the band. That's how we got the band names from his email address. And at some point, we found a guy named Andrew Luxem, and we decided he's the guy somehow that we would do a record with. Played some shows with him, of course. We started working on a record, and I worked at EMP, the Experience Music Project, and that was a great job for a little while. I could play my guitar like for hours a day, and I kind of wrote the finer points of that record, both on keyboard and guitar, while I was working. And I feel it's very strange. It's my nature is, if I'm getting paid to do something else, I love to play guitar, but I have a hard time practicing when I'm not getting paid for something else to do it. You know, it's kind of like people like to, never mind, sit on the toilet or something while they're working. It's just doing something else, getting paid to do something aside from actually working, you know. But EMP Museum is the Experience Music Project. It's in Seattle. And legitimately, you could play guitar, you could play keyboard in the Sound Lab, I think it was called. You could I used to record music with friends there. It was a great job. But at some point, so we'd stand in front of the doors and people would walk around and hear you play guitar and things like that. And at some point, one of the managers, who, his name was Kent Fowamzi. That's what he would sound like. Ken Fowamzi, go ahead. You know, on the walkie-talkies we would use. He was a fellow from perhaps Vietnam, perhaps. I think he was a nice dude. I don't think he should have been managing a rock and roll establishment such as the EMP, you know, with Nirvana and Jimi Hendrix and a ton of really cool like exhibitions that rotated throughout the world and throughout this place. It was, anyway, I think he should have been managing some kind of like a Kmart or a Walmart. He was, he didn't give a fuck about rock and roll, basically. And he started trying to take our guitars away. And eventually he took our guitars away. Once this like silverback gorilla guy left, who wouldn't give up his guitar and probably would fight for it, Kent said the guitars are going. And he tried to make up something that a guitar got smashed, fell down some stairs, and the story kept changing. It sounded like total bullshit to me. I rebelled and brought in my own guitar, and when he saw that I brought in my own guitar, he was totally pissed, like he had lost control of me. So somehow he got me to not play guitar anymore, and the job wasn't nearly as fun. I bitched at anybody who would listen for 3 months straight, probably, about that fucking guitar and how this guy shouldn't be managing this place. I can't help myself sometimes, right? Sometimes I'm just working these jobs, and at some point, I just find myself talking trash, and it's something I gotta watch. You know, it's not a great, doesn't make me feel good. But once I start talking shit about everything and everybody and every manager at a job, it's time for me to go. And it was time. Apparently, he let me go at some point. He laid me off. He laid me and my buddy, Mike, who I'm still really good friends with. I just talked today. Mike Mankos, he laid us off. We both got fired on exactly the same day. But, anyway, getting back to Smile Brigade, I wrote most of the record, a lot of the record, and God, it just, you need time to write music. It just, you really do. It takes a long, it's a very subtle process. It takes a lot of hours, a lot of man hours, you know, thousands of hours, maybe, well, hundreds at least. It's like making a novel, basically. You know, you put out a record, you could have done a novel, right? I mean, I'm writing a novel. I kind of put it on the side burner because it was just too much. I was trying to do a podcast, music, novel, work, girlfriend. Not in that order, of course. Girlfriend first, of course. Girlfriend first. But, I was trying to write a novel, and I still am. But you can write like 1,000 pages, you know, I'm sorry, 1,000 words in a night. And you need about 50,000 to 60,000 words to make a 350-page novel. So they take about the same amount of time, I think, if you were talking about writing and recording a record. Anyway, we put out a record, me, Andrew, and Jeremy, called Take the Precious Edge Off This Treacherous Ledge. Once again, Take the Precious Edge Off This Treacherous Ledge. And, let me back up. Technically speaking, we put out a single before that, me and Jeremy, where we played everything, and that was Sing Song. There's a song that we did called Sing Song, and we played it probably every single show. Probably the greatest song we wrote, one of the first ones, and I don't know. It probably sums up the band. I'm actually going to play that song at the end of this podcast for you guys. I'm not going to play it myself. I'm going to play our recorded version of it. It was about an ex-girlfriend who actually died of cancer. Her name was Sarah. And, you know, I don't know. I wanted it to sound kind of like Nirvana's About a Girl. And if you listen to the drum beat when they come in, that's kind of mimicked that. Anyway, we put out Sing Song with the B-side. It was called End of World Cartoon. Fast forward to the record I'm talking about. It's a white cover. If you guys want a copy, you can probably go online and buy it. You can hit me up. It's called Take the Precious Edge Off This Treacherous Ledge. I've got vinyl still. This was a long time ago, but I still got copies of it if you guys would like. But it's like 10 or 11 songs. We recorded it with a guy named Andy Meyer, I think was his last name. And it was a labor of love. It was really great. We did it mostly in my basement. I remember eating every single day, because this dude was a vegetarian, like a pizzatarian. Is that a thing? But he would only eat cheese pizza. And then we'd have Diet Mountain Dew. So every single day, it was Diet Mountain Dew and Red Baron pizza. Red Baron's the finest cheap pizza around. It tastes great. It's really cheap. When I was in Seattle, I could get it for like for $9, I could get 3 of them. That was at the grocery outlet, or if you're into Brevity, Gross Out, I'd get it from there. Anyway, me and Andy, it's just such a laborious process. I mean, he did it for free, basically. We were there every day for a couple months, maybe. Not every single day. It took us a long damn time. When we finished it, we gave a copy. We printed up 1,000 copies, had some cool artwork. Originally, it was going to be bag paintings by this amazing artist named Chris Kreitz, who I've also interviewed. Check him out. I think he's still in my backlog of podcasts. But then, of course, as soon as we get the third bag painting, you know, this guy did like really cool kind of really colorful pop art on paper bags, portraits. He did a portrait of every band member. But as soon as we finished the cover, one of the guys quit. Andrew quit. And Andrew quit right before a gig, and we had this great sound, great harmonies. People were kind of vibing on it, kind of reacting. But that's how shit goes. I don't know. I felt like every great band member I've had was kind of the band. His position with the band was corrupted by a female, and I can't even sweat that. I'm not blaming them. Hey, look, women, babies, family. It's all very, very important. You know, much more important than some band most of the time. But, you know, unless that band's making a ton of money, then usually the band's more important than the women. That's kind of how it works. But Andrew, I think his... I remember him saying, like, his wife didn't like the band, or his girlfriend at the time, who's his wife now, didn't really like the band, and I think she kind of influenced him away from it. But anyway, he announced he was going to quit. We were really sad, pissed off, because we were just about to put out this record. We decided to put it out anyway. The thing is, once you lose a member, it's really hard to recreate things a lot of times, especially if the member's doing more than just playing a simple beat or a simple bass line. He did a lot of backup harmony vocals, and it just, there's no fucking way we would have replaced them. So we did like a CD release party with a couple new members, and they were called Leonardo and Peter. And Leonardo and Peter would kind of end up being the classic Smile Brigade. We'd put out an EP with them, Earring Creaky, and a full length. I believe we released Take the Precious Edge Off This Treacherous Ledge. What the fuck was it? I guess it would have been the High Dive. Was that where it went? I think so, the High Dive in Seattle. And we practically sold it out. We had a couple bands, but it was like there was like 250 people there. And just before that, we had like played The End, right? And we played after Nirvana's About a Girl played, which was kind of cool. My sister-in-law informed me of that at the time. And I remember a guy coming up to me and just being like, man, I'm so happy for your success. I'm like, oh, wow, that's cool. And KEXP was playing it. The local Seattle record, you know, Wonderkind record station, radio station, indie radio station. It used to be KCMU, but it changed to KEXP, I think, when it started getting funding by Paul Allen. And yes, that's the same guy who funded the Experience Music Project, the EMP. A lot of using the word experience because of Jimi Hendrix, who is from Seattle. And, you know, Jimi Hendrix and the Experience. But yeah, KEXP was playing it. We did an in-store. We did some in-stores, but we did an in-studio at KEXP. Cheryl Waters was the one who hosted it, and I know we did shitty. I don't know. We were trying to play these songs, but it just wasn't with the original people. We ended up writing some really cool songs with those people, but we were trying to flog this record that was done kind of with somebody else. And I remember Cheryl Waters, I would say she was kind of rude. She probably doesn't even remember us, which is fine, but it was kind of like... she's a pretty famous DJ on there, and they were like, I remember one of her handlers or somebody came up to her directly after we got done playing, and they go, Cheryl, would you like to take a picture with the band? Like he had a camera on him and like offering this camera, would you like to take a picture? Like she was royalty or something. She couldn't even pronounce Smile Brigade, I remember. And she goes, I don't have time for this, and like walked out really quickly. So clearly we were not a hit at KEXP. But, you know, we always had fun. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be negative. I just... I don't know why. I was kind of pissed off at Cheryl Waters at the time, and I never really forgot it. Every time I see her on some YouTube clip, I'm like, man, that chick, she dissed us, man. Anyway, water under the bridge for real. Smile Brigade went on a couple tours with Peter and Leonardo. Peter played keyboards. Peter's a brilliant guy. Leonardo is too. They were both great. Totally eclectic. Totally. Leonardo was one of the most fashionable people you'd ever meet. You know, like people would stop him in the street to like take his picture and put it in the local, you know, fish wrapper magazine, The Stranger or something. I never read The Stranger after like the year 2000. I got too addicted to it, and I don't know, at some point I thought it was propaganda. They were trying to get us to like convince everybody who to vote for. Like they'd have a vote, like a vote cheat sheet, and it really was cheating, like influence an entire bunch of people who didn't give a shit other than to be trendy and go along with The Stranger. Anyway, I digress. Leonardo, super well-dressed. Peter was pretty well-dressed too. He was kind of a... Actually, Peter was impeccably dressed. I was definitely the schlub motherfucker in the band. Jeremy was, it was like I was, you know, kind of like didn't give a fuck. Then Jeremy, then Peter, then Leonardo. Leonardo played bass. He played like a demon, really melodic. Peter was one of the greater musicians I've ever run into. He kind of like has composed classical music. Check him out, Peter Kolklaser. He's done a ton of shit. He's been working with bands out there in just south of San Francisco. He's down there, and he just keeps putting out music. He's really, really talented. So he started becoming a force in the music. And one of the great things about playing with Peter was that prior to that, I had always kind of had to really painstakingly figure out, you know, notes and melodies. And I wondered if things worked and work out keyboard lines really. The Smile Brigade did have some keyboards on their first record that me and Jeremy kind of wrote. But with Peter, he was so quick. He just grokked it immediately. He copped these lines at every single... And he was like the professor, right? We called him Wikipedia. Super smart guy. You'd get comments like, why is that guy in your band? And I had a funny memory of Peter. He was up there. We were in Bellingham playing one time. And I just pulled some random memories of people in the band. And he was kind of... He was talking... in his way that he talks, which is very scholarly and very very astute, very very clear, very nice, very rosy-cheeked, you know? And some some guy in the audience like stops him in the middle of what he's saying and goes, where'd you learn how to talk like such an asshole? And I just cracked up at this dude. And Peter stopped in his tracks and was kind of embarrassed or something. And I remember even after the thing, like, there's those times in life when, like, your ego was kind of bruised to the point of you can't really remember what even happened. Like, your mind won't let you recall it. You know, like, I had that when I was a little kid, like, dudes challenging me to a fight or something in a parking lot and me, like, having some weird... You know, like that I didn't even see the person, but I was a kid and they were coming from some car, but then I disassociated it or something, and I'd like couldn't even remember what happened, but it was like a weird dream or something. I don't know. And I feel like Peter couldn't really process that dude asking him, why do you talk like such an asshole? Peter doesn't talk like an asshole. This guy was actually an asshole. Peter was just being himself. I don't even know what he was saying, but it was funny to me. We did some tours. The memories that stick out with touring. So first of all, Leonardo, awesome as well. Jeremy's great. Like it was a great little group. We got along very well. We got a van for the band. Wow, how times have changed. We had a van called the Turtle. We were making videos inside the van. It was just really cool, man. Jeremy was very crafty. He kind of put all these crafty things together and helped promote us in a very like kind of DIY fashion. Leonardo would kind of bring a bunch of people to the shows. A bunch of people. We'd have like Christmas sweater shows, and we'd give out prizes. It was always a really good time, you know. Peter would be the professor, and I would kind of be mostly the singer. But Peter actually sang a couple songs as well, like a handful. And at some point, our very last recording was a single, and you can find that on iTunes. One was called Brianna, was one song. The other song was called, Jesus Christ, why can't I remember it? Anyway, they were both A-sides, and I can't remember the name of Peter's song. That's crazy. I will remember in a second. But anyway, I think that was like the greatest song we ever did, the one that Peter came up with. The chords are brilliant. And at that point, towards the end, whatever, we'll get to that later. But we had another guitarist, and we had two guitarists. And it just came together so seamlessly. Had such a good time. Anyway, we did some touring. Some things that stand out for me tour wise, I loved playing Los Angeles. I loved how late that crowd was. I loved how enthusiastic and nice they were. LA's been nothing but good to me. I remember rolling into, this is a great story. I'll give you guys two specific shows that I remember that stick out to me that unbelievably cool in my memory banks. So we're doing this tour for, I don't even know, was it the second record or the first record? I don't know. We did about six tours, and we toured as far south as San Diego and as far east as Chicago. Never went to Texas, but we went to New Mexico and everything in between all those points. We had a show in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and this girl, who's actually become a very good friend, her name was Anna, she showed up and she was convinced, because we were such a hot band, that she had to get there early. She knew we were going to sell out. But the fact is, nobody knew about us whatsoever. Bless her heart, but she was like in the know because she was at a radio station in a nearby town called Las Vegas, New Mexico. Yes, there's a tiny town called Las Vegas, New Mexico. It's great. It's a cool little community. They have great, like, food, you know. I don't know. They have great parks downtown. I love the park downtown. It's like an Old West situation. It's pretty cool. I was there about a year and a half ago. Anyway, she comes down. She's one of the five people there. She thought it would be sold out. Obviously, it wasn't. And she goes, I can get you guys a show in New Mexico. And in Las Vegas, New Mexico. Can you play tomorrow? And we had a day off the next day, but we said, well, fuck it. I don't need a day off. So we did an in studio, I believe, at her radio station. Then she got us a great gig opening up for the movie Iron Man 2. So whatever year that was, when Iron Man 2 came out, and it was like this welcome back to school party for the whole town. And so the whole town came out, and they filled this theater. This theater was pretty big, like a Blue Oyster Cult had played there before or after, you know, within a couple months of us playing there. And so we played in this grand old theater in the middle of Las Vegas, New Mexico, with, I don't know, 200 or 300 people. And it was total rock star moment. It was great. It was fucking radical. And we partied all night, did some karaoke. I remember singing the Thong Song with Leonardo. I remember singing David Bowie, Modern Love. That was a great memory. That was so cool. Thank you, Anna. She, I don't know, we became friends. She owned this like adobe house in Santa Fe, or sorry, Las Vegas. And it was so cool. It was just like adobe house is kind of made out of some kind of material that stays, they're really cool looking, and they're kind of native to that area of America, at least. Probably other parts of the world as well. But I mean, I'm sure they're in other parts of the world. I just can't recall which countries right now. I don't want to look like that much of an idiot. I never had geography in high school. But anyway, they stay cool in the summer and warm in the winter. And she let us stay there, and we just had a grand time. So that's one show that sticks out. Another show that sticks out to me is a Fargo, North Dakota show. Fargo, North Dakota, I was, we showed up, it was cold as hell. I remember it was like my niece Gracie's birthday, and I made a little video and sent it to her, put it on YouTube so she could watch it. And we played this show, opening for this cat named Charlie Parr. Now, Charlie Parr is like a local folk legend around there. He was great. He was so good. He actually, he was really inspiring. It was just him and a guitar, but he had the stomp box. It was like a piece of wood, and you'd put a microphone in the piece of wood and maybe put a little reverb or echo or something on it, and you'd stomp while you were playing. So basically, it was like, you know, when you're listening to disco or like a good rock song, you just hear that incessant boom, boom. You know, that incessant bass drum. And that's what he would do. So it was like a very simple setup. He would just kick this block of wood with a mic in it and just kill it on the guitar. And that place filled up, right? And we opened for this guy. And I guess these people hadn't seen live music, you know, it was like February or something. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe it was around spring break. Was that even the same tour? I don't know. They all blend together. But anyway, it was February, and people hadn't seen live music in Fargo, North Dakota for a while. And it was at a venue called the Aquarium. And we just had this amazing show. It was like exactly what we needed. The whole crowd just went fucking nuts. And it was just this rapturous applause. I met like some really cool women that I'm still in contact with. And I remember telling the crowd, like, you know, it's just random. One of these random moments I remember, I just go, yeah, we're leaving. We basically left right after the show to drive to like Montana. And I told the crowd that. And I said, well, sorry, ladies, you know, sorry, girls, you know, something like that. And the whole place, like, woo! You know, it's just, it was very, very fun. Super fun times of an unknown band, right? And yeah, so Fargo and Las Vegas, just great times. I love nothing more than traveling around and to be able to play a show. I don't know if I prefer playing a show or travel. I love playing shows, but traveling's just great. To be honest, there's a lot of like waiting around to play a show and a fair amount of nerves involved, because sometimes you can psych yourself out. You can be like, is tonight gonna suck? Is it gonna be any good? Is it gonna be terrible? And at some point you'll get that feeling like it's a pall over your thought process and over your mind, and you're like, this show's gonna be terrible, and you can't think yourself out of it, and it ends up being terrible. The best way to approach is really to not think about it at all. But then you're like, if I don't think about it, what if I forget the songs? I gotta be conscious. But really, you're gonna remember the songs. If you can just go in there not giving a fuck, like, you probably kick some ass. That's what I've learned anyway. I mean, you have to be prepared, but at some point, you know, you can't prepare anymore, right? Like, when I do interviews with my podcasts, and you guys, anybody listening now can go back through, I've done a lot of interviews, I get all stressed out about researching, you know, my subject, whatever it is, and then at some point, it just hits me, it's like, dude, the interview's in an hour, you will never know anything more. All you're going to do is fuck this up if you try to over-prepare. Just be natural about it, you know. Anyway, I think it's similar to a show. It's playing a show. It's all performance-based stuff, right? I think podcasting is to me, performance-based, just like playing a show, in a sense. You got to be on, you know, you got to have your angles, you got to be witty, whatever it is, which is why I do it. I love the performance aspect. Thank you all for listening. So, at some point, Smile Brigade put out, what the fuck did we put on? Put on an EP. I don't remember remember the order exactly, but we put out an EP called Earring Creaky, and it was all acoustic, and we got a guy from a band called Minivan to help us play guitar on that one, and we recorded it at Mysterious Red X with Andy Meyer. And I think Andy Meyer, now you listen to any of these recordings, I think he was a good engineer. I don't think he was that great at mixing down, because since then I've mixed down with other people who made the shit sound great. Or maybe it just was better, I don't know. Maybe the personnel was different, I don't quite know. But I know nothing, well no, that's not true. The first record was mixed pretty good. I just didn't think Earring Creaky or Do You Come Here Often, we'll get to that in a second, we're mixed very well, but whatever. The songs are pretty damn good, and some of them were great. Just, I don't know. There's something about one guitar and one keyboard that doesn't always mesh for me. I think it's, you got to have two guitars or two guitars and a keyboard. I like keyboard more, augmenting things, not being the primary instrument. But anyway, Peter was a great keyboardist. So we did Earring Creaky at Mysterious Red X. That was super fun. That got a little bit of play on KEXP, but diminishing, right? Like, it wasn't as much as that first record. And I don't know that it was a worse record. It was just, you know, for some reason, everything we did after that first one kind of less and less and less, which is how things go sometimes. Earring Creaky was cool. And then we did a record called Do You Come Here Often? And Do You Come Here Often? There's some great songs on there. We did Sing Song on that one again, which is a repeat from our first single, with me and Jeremy. We did a song called The Mother's Day Song. We did a song called Killjoy Switch. You guys can find all this stuff. If you go and put Smile Brigade into any, you know, Spotify or iTunes or Apple Music, any of those streaming, you know, models that don't really pay musicians anything just because, you know, like somebody's getting rich off them, but the musicians certainly aren't, you know. Not that I'm trying to get rich. I'm saying for people who do get millions of streams, but you know, get pennies on, you know, slices of pennies on every play, you know, whatever. Smokey Robinson and whatnot, who should be a billionaire, but you know, the dude just got a little money from the MMA, the Musical Modernization Act. Thanks, Trump. Look into that, guys. Music Modernization Act. Oh yeah. And by the way, I know I just said go ahead and listen to Smile Brigade, because I don't care. All that music's on all these streaming things. But to be honest, go ahead and buy CDs. It's great to be able to put a CD in and memorize the track listing like we used to do, you know? Put it in your car and just cruise around like a champ and just feel fucking young again and feel amazing. That's do that, man. Or, I don't know, I wouldn't even buy it from iTunes. I would buy it on CD. I would burn it on a disc. Well, I'd take it in your car for sure. Or I would transfer it to your player. That's what I would do, but whatever. Do whatever the fuck you want. I actually listen to Apple Music, and I don't feel terrible, but I feel slightly guilty, like I'm a hypocrite, because I still buy a lot of CDs, but I only buy the CDs I really want to listen to. I won't just buy random CDs, any of that shit. I mean, I can literally push a button on my phone and say, Siri, play me anything, and it plays. You know, it's not the greatest quality, but it plays. It's too fucking convenient, but people are getting totally ripped off. Anyway, I'll quit preaching. Let me take a drink of this Diet Coke. We did a record called, Do You Come Here Often? And it's got great artwork on it. It's got us standing on this map on the front in each state we were from. And it's got, on the inside, some great photos taken by Leonardo's friends. He was very artsy. You knew a bunch of photographers and stuff. Just really cool. The record, I think, had it been mixed better, would have been better. You know, I don't think I'll ever remix it. I don't think I have the masters, but, you know, that's how it goes. When it's really weird, I kind of felt like, I mean, I am proud of the songs on that, and I am proud for accomplishing it, but it's weird. It's kind of like making, you know, a movie. Can you imagine spending 6 months or a year doing something, and at the end you knew that it didn't quite come together like you wanted it to, but you're out of money. You've been talking about it for a year. You got to put something out. Well, that's kind of what happened. It got a little bit of play on KEXP, but not as much as that first record, which is weird. I mean, there's some great songs in there. Really great musicianship. Like I said, Peter and Leonardo really took us to a really interesting level. We were very much who would I compare us to? Somebody compared us to like the Shins mixed with the Doors, which is really high praise. Those are both amazing bands. You know, whatever. I would check out the song if you want to hear. Fuck it. You know what? Just go find Smile Brigade. There's tons of live stuff on YouTube and any of those streaming services. You can find every bit of everything we did. So I'll stop right there. We did some more touring, blah blah blah. The tours all just blend together, but they're so fun, you know. The Junk Food Superhighway, you know, one thing about touring is most places you stop are like, you know, gas stations and truck stops, and that's really cool. I love that feeling, walking into a place like with just your socks on because you were just sleeping in the van, and you're looking around, people are looking at you like a freak, but you're feeling just wide-eyed and wily and wired and cool and like a road warrior, and you're inclined to eat a bunch of junk food, but don't eat the junk food. You know, get a piece of a fruit and some water or juice. Because, man, you eat that junk food and you keep eating it, some deep-fried shit. I know it looks good because you're just going to keep going. You get sick within 3 days. And it sucks getting sick on the road. I've been sick as a dog on the road. My buddy Peter was sick as a dog on the road. Oh my God. He was sick in, I think he was sick in Minneapolis at a venue that Prince played at, apparently. It was just, I don't even know, I don't remember what the name, it wasn't the Uptown. That's like a big venue. Might have been, no, I think it wasn't the Uptown. But it was some restaurant where literally like the back wall of the restaurant like swung open and you could load your gear in. And at nighttime, they would convert it into an old, you know, into a venue. Apparently, it had been there for decades and decades, and Prince had played there. You know, that's, Prince is the man around there. And so is Wilco, I guess. But I've never been into Wilco. Man, hats off to those dudes. But I've never, ever been into Wilco. They bore the living daylights out of me. No doubt, you know, and my music would probably bore them too. I'm just saying, like, it's my opinion on Wilco. I think they're from that same area. And maybe Husker Du. Now, Husker Du's pretty cool. Husker Du's from, what the fuck does that mean? Even mean Husker Du? With the little, two little dots on top of the U. Husker Du. Bob Mould was the singer. And like a year ago, I was obsessed with this Bob Mould song that he played with the Foo Fighters. Sorry, it was a Foo Fighters song that he sang on it. Called Dear Rosemary. Oh, powerful song. I watched a Foo Fighters documentary, and those documentaries always get me. Like, I even got into the Eagles this year because of a documentary, which is crazy. Because I made fun of the Eagles my entire life, but then all of a sudden I'm like, hey, man, that's a pretty amazing feat what they did. You know, all those hits. Every member, and really, though, every member of the Eagles wrote, like, a badass hit. It's like a masterpiece, you know. Even the bass player, especially the drummer. And then we got, you know, crazy ass James Gang. What's his name? The guitarist from James Gang who joined them. He's just apparently just a rebel. He just total rebel. Everybody from that generation loves Joe Walsh. His name is Joe Walsh. Anyway, yeah, go Eagles. But yeah, we're in Minneapolis and Peter got really sick. Credibility. Cool. Oh, a couple other cool shows. Smile Brigade. We got to open for a couple of my heroes. One of my favorite bands of all time was a band on Hardly Art Records. They just put out two albums. You know, it's kind of like that band Rose Windows, another one of my favorite bands. Just two records, and the tension between the bandmates, whatever it was too much, and they just disappeared. And to be honest, those people in those two projects probably won't ever reach those heights again. It's just how it goes. It's a shame. I wish they could have kept it together. But the band I'm referring to is called The Duchess and the Duke. We got to open up for them downtown Seattle. What the hell is that place called? Just this DIY club, and it was just so fun. It was such a good goddamn time, and I loved that band so much. I was like, it was just a two-piece. It's a guy and a girl, and they're totally like Leonard Cohen meets Rolling Stones. Very, very like stripped down. Like I said, just two people and maybe a tambourine occasionally. And I was like, I think they were using my amp, and I was stoked that they were using my amp. And I was like singing along to their songs to the point of like the girl shot me a couple looks, like, quiet down, motherfucker. And Jesse Lortz, who, brilliant guy, but not really a social type of guy. I wanted to get a record signed, so I asked him after the show, do you have a record? Could you sign it for me? And he just kind of like pulled a Thom Yorke on me. And kind of just like walked in a huff to his car, didn't say a word as I'm like trailing behind, you know, too cool to even talk to me really, after we just played a show. And then he like grabs the record, signs it in red ink and hands it back. I still got it. Anyway, that was great, okay. Loved opening for the Duchess and Duke, super proud. I think I still got the flyer. And then I got to open for Built to Spill as well. Built to Spill, If you lived in the Northwest between 1996 and 2010, Built to Spill was one of those bands. I mean, as far as American indie rock goes, I don't know if you what you would call that. I mean, college rock kind of morphed into alternative, kind of morphed into indie. Indie being, you know, all like, well, alternative kind of started out as a mainstream deal, but college rock started out underground. And I think so did indie. And, you know, after the first wave of indie rock in America, like, you know, your Sebadoes and your Pavement, things like that, just after Nirvana, you had like Built to Spill and you had Modest Mouse and you had Sleater-Kinney. In fact, those three bands were the biggest bands around, you know, at the time. Like those three bands were it. I think they kind of defined like 96, 97, 98, you know? And Built to Spill was amazing. They totally got Modest Mouse signed, and Modest Mouse kind of sounds like Built to Spill, but you know, Modest Mouse ended up getting bigger than Built to Spill, just because Isaac Brock's such a force of nature, you know. Doug Marsh is a little more subtle, the singer of Built to Spill, but he's badass. He's just like a classic guitar player. We got to open for those guys at some park in the University of Washington, you know, and that was super fun, you know. So like, two of my fantasies kind of fulfilled in a way with Smile Brigade. You know, we did a whole shit ton of shows, you know. I am proud that we kept that band going for so long. At some point, you know, Jeremy, our drummer, had a baby. He was getting, I mean, it's just my opinion. You can hit him up, Jeremy Charbonneau. He was torn. I mean, he wasn't torn between his family and the band, but, you know, there were some decisions had to be made. You know, I remember getting some phone calls from him, and he was in a bad spot, you know, and over it. And it became too much. And at some point, you know, he kind of, we got another drummer for a gig, and he kind of slowly started to splinter off. And before that, though, we did that this single, like I told you about. It was so good. Go check it out. Brianna and Lovey Dovey. Brianna and Lovey Dovey. I was just so happy about that band, about those four guys. And we had a guy named Cameron Yates, actually, who played on those two songs. And I was so glad because they came out so good, you know. And I love a band right before they break up for real, like putting out something that's great. And I do think those two songs are great. You know, it's just like Breaking Bad, you know, it stopped after five seasons. It didn't go on too long. It was just perfect. And it really ensures the legacy. Or the Beatles, you know, I'm not comparing us to the Beatles, but I'm saying like they quit when they're still kind of on top of their game, you know. I mean, one might argue Let It Be isn't amazing, but certainly Abbey Road is amazing, and that was the last thing they did. So I liked that. I liked the very last thing we did. We did a couple great shows. We did a show at Numo's. We did a show at the Crocodile, and they weren't sold out, but there was like 200 or 300 people there. We did a show at Numo's. The place was packed. Like, they did an interview with me at some bar before that, and just a bunch of people showed up. It was just such a good time. I ordered a pizza during the show. We covered Mother by John Lennon. We had Rebecca Felice on keyboard, and she's like Macklemore's cello player. She's amazing. She's a friend of ours, you know. That was before Macklemore, but now she's like jet set and famous. You know, she plays with everybody. She deserves it. She's a badass. But it was a big spectacle. I mean, I ended that show, you know, had a pizza delivered, handing out pizza, people just grooving, having a good time. A bunch of kids were there. I think it was all ages. I ended that show kind of like, I did Mother by John Lennon and ended up on my back with my head in the audience, and I was just so exhausted and like sweating and hot. Some dude put like a fucking beer on my forehead. I'm just back, practically passed out with my eyes closed, and dude puts a cold beer on my forehead, and my initial reaction was like, this motherfucker just rested a beer on my forehead. But then I go, oh man, that actually feels pretty good, you know, roll with it, man, just roll with it. And so that was great. We did a Day of the Dead show at the Crocodile with Julia Massey and the Five Finger Discount. I remember the system was so powerful, and we played with Cameron, and that's what we always needed. We always needed an extra guitarist like Cameron. He just was so tasteful, and he so texturized, you know. It's those little things, like the songs were there, like I wrote the songs, mostly, and Peter wrote the song, but this dude just accented shit so nicely, and shit sounded so good, and I didn't have to worry too much about my guitar playing and singing. It was more about, I could concentrate on just, you know, playing the simple things that I played, and let everybody fill it out in their own way. Super cool, though, you know. A Smile Brigade, fuck yeah. And it just splintered, you know. Jeremy was gonna leave. Leonardo said he's out. Peter was moving to San Jose. That's where it was. And we did a couple, I think we did our last show, I think, at the High Dive. It was kind of anticlimactic because it was a release for those two songs, but we'd already booked the show, but the guy got pissed because somebody offered us Pneumos. Because what happens, you put out a bunch of feelers for what show you want to play, and the dude probably never forgave me. We were supposed to do our big show at High Dive, but then I went ahead and took the Pneumos show, and he was rightfully pissed. Like, we're obviously going to promote the Pneumos show. Whatever, man, we did it. And that was the last show at the High Dive. I kept going with the band for a bit, and we had some pretty cool shows. It was a totally new lineup after they all left. And I didn't even really want to call it Smile Brigade. And to be honest, I probably shouldn't have. But it was just easier, and I still like wanted to hold on to the name, and Zach wanted to hold on to the name as well. Zach the drummer, who actually Zach played that show at, what am I talking about, at Pneumos with us, and whatever. So he replaced Jeremy at the very end. He's a good, great drummer. He just learned Jeremy's parts exactly. And then we had like a punk rock version of Smile Brigade. You know, we really didn't play any of those old songs, maybe one or two. But we kind of, I wrote a bunch of like real punky songs. And to be honest, I don't know if it sounded like Nirvana, but you know, our drummer was so into Nirvana and I had those leanings as well that at some point, like, it doesn't sound like Nirvana, but it's got that, I don't know. There was some influence there. I would just say that. But it was still really fun. The greatest memory I have from that particular version of Smile Brigade, we went to play a place in Portland, the Tonic Lounge, and I recognized some dude at the bar vaguely. Actually, I don't know if I recognized him, but he was just a weird looking cat, and he was kind of charismatic. And we go in and we play, and there's a few people there, and people are grooving, having a good time. And all of a sudden, we cover a song by the Wipers called Over the Edge. And it's just a barn-burning song. It's so great. I mean, check out the Wipers, guys. If you guys don't know Wipers, please check them out. And this is how I got into Dead Moon, this story. We played that song, and some crazy-looking dude with, like, gray hair and a hat on, long gray hair, comes in and just starts fucking thrashing to this song. Just thrashing. Just totally getting into it. Runs in and just starts going nuts. And it was great. We ended the song Over the Edge by the Wipers, and he just like screaming at us, "You guys fucking nailed it. You guys fucking nailed it. Fuck yeah." You know, he was really into it. And the sound man afterwards, because I think I asked about him, he said, "That was Dead Moon's drummer. That was Andrew, I don't know his last name, but he's like a total legend. Like in Europe and in indie rock." I mean, Dead Moon, if you don't know Dead Moon, please check out Dead Moon. In my opinion, the only two bands to come out of Portland ever are Dead Moon and the Wipers. Total rock and roll, like, they'll school you, man. That shit will school you. Listen to the, between punk and like punky, garagey blues and DIY. I mean, Dead Moon's the godfather and mother of DIY. Anyway, yeah, check out the movie Unknown Passage, I believe it's called. Anyway, it's totally phenomenal. But, I don't even know if I got to meet that guy, but he was going ape shit, and I remember putting it together like, well, shit, if I had heard of Dead Moon before, and if Dead Moon likes the Wipers, then I got to check out Dead Moon. And it was like love at first listen, you know, just totally, totally getting into it. Yeah, so we did a handful of shows. It was super fun. Bottom line is Zach, he was very, very, Zach the drummer, man, interesting cat. I'll talk about him for a second. The two main guys in that portion, we had a couple other players, played a couple shows, but mostly it was like Stan and Zach, and we had a revolving line of bass players, to be honest. We had a guy named James, who was great. We had my friend Matt, he's a dude from New Jersey. Anyway, James was actually with us quite a while. Super fun. But what are we talking about? Oh, actually, you know what? We also did a show and opened for Chad Channing's band up in, like, you know, the islands in northern Washington, you know, northwestern Washington. And that was actually phenomenal. We killed it, man. They loved it. And I got to party with, like, the drummer from Nirvana and drink this, like, sweet mead wine with the dude. And just bro down. And it was just, that was a really magical fucking night. They were, like, doing a CD release party. And we went with them and just magic, man. It was total magic. I think we did that twice. So, yeah, there actually, that final incarnation of Smile Brigade, now that I think of it, there were some great times. Really, really a couple great, great shows. We never did record anything. I couldn't hold a band together long enough to record something. It just got weirder and weirder. And at some point, we'd play these, like, great shows, and Zach would say something like, well, I don't want to play any more than once per month. And I just felt like anytime we got any kind of inertia or the band started going, he would just kind of pull back. Like, I could see it happening. It was this cycle. It was like a horror movie. Like, I just saw it. It was weird. Like, something's coming, you know. Something's dark, and it's weird. It fucking bothers me. Like, why won't this dude get on board? He just wouldn't. The dude had a nice job. Hey, no offense to him, but it really pissed me off at the time. He had a nice job. He did his thing. And so it wasn't that important to him. And so, you know, there was tension there. The band was asking me, like, well, what's up with Zach? Like, why won't he play? Like, we want to do these shows. I said, I don't fucking know. And Zach would tell me things like, Jesse, I have to tell you no sometimes. I don't like telling you no, but you're the person I've had to tell no to the most out of any band member. You always just want me to play and do things I'm not comfortable with. And I'm thinking, like, well, dude, that's what bands do. Like, the bandmates are asking me, and why aren't you playing? Don't you know that? So anyway, there's this one song called, the thing that broke up the band finally was this song called, we call it Black. Not to be confused with the horrible Pearl Jam song Black. This one's much better than that. Anyway, just kidding. Black is a good song. I don't personally like it. I'm not really a Pearl Jam fan. I tend to pit bands against each other. I've been the Nirvana guy. You know, it's like, when Modest Mouse was pitted versus Death Cab for Cutie, I'm a Modest Mouse guy, you know. Beatles versus Stones, come on. Do you have to ask? Anyway, what broke up the band, and I always had this dream, and I'm going to record, I'm doing music now again, right? I'm recording, and you guys know about that. If you go back, listen to the last couple episodes, you'll hear a bunch of stuff about the recording that I'm doing. And we're going to record this song that broke up that band. And I don't know. I always knew it was a really good song. I always knew it was a really solid melody, and I wanted to jam it with these guys. But we just couldn't do it. They didn't want to play it. They'd make fun of it. I don't know. It was just, but I liked it. And I kept pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And nobody was ever straight with me, like they didn't like it or something. It was just like we couldn't get it down. And at some point, they're just talking shit, and I decided, well, fuck you guys. And Stan's talking mad shit. And, you know, there's people in the world where, like, they just feel free to show their ass and talk shit to you. And it's only your class that, like, keeps you from just, like, dressing them down. And they kind of know that. Like, they know that in mixed company, you're not going to, like, fire back or tell them to go fuck themselves when you could, but they use that, like, in a social situation. I don't know. It's not a time to be timid, but, like, that's what's happening. You just are timid around people, and people know that, and they'll pick up, and they'll kind of expose it. Well, Stan was like that a little bit. He talked shit in mixed company, because I worked with him, too. And at some point, he's like, talking shit about this song called Black. And I guess he just didn't like it, but really he just didn't like me anymore. Like, that's really what was going on. But, you know, one of those people can't differentiate, like, they don't like you, so they just talk shit about something and act like it's something more than just having an issue with you. And I just, like, laser-focused, like, everything he said. I don't even remember what was said, but I just fired it directly back at him. Straight-faced. Bam. What was that? Oh, yeah, actually, blah, blah, blah. Right back at him. And about the third one, he just goes, you know, because a guy like that can't handle it. It's like a bully. They crack, right? You know, and I had played nice up until that point, you know, but I just fired back and I didn't care anymore and blah, blah, blah. And he just goes, that's it. And he unplugs his guitar, puts it in the case, rolls up his cords, puts his amp in my van. I silently drive him back to his house. And then I have to go to work the next day with him. And things were never the same. It's fucking weird. Totally weird. I talked to Zach. I said, Zach, if we do anything with this band, if it gets any bigger, would you ever be willing to play more than once a month? He said no. Then he gave me this spiel about having to tell me no. It's like, all right, well, that's it. So that was officially the end of Smile Brigade right there. We went on a long time, many, many different people, many, many shows. We probably played 200 shows, Smile Brigade. And you can probably see most of those incarnations, most of those variables on YouTube. So go check it out. But shit, man. That's it. I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank the fans of Smile Brigade, the people who encouraged us, family members, the people who maybe even gave me money to help pay for some recordings, possibly, former bandmates. It's a celebration, bitches. You know, Jeremy, for sure. Peter, for sure. Leonardo, for sure. Andrew, for sure. Zach, for sure. Thank you. Stan, even. Thanks, buddy. Matt, Cameron. You guys all know who you are. Thanks for being part of that little thing, that little bit of history, my personal history. I got some great mementos from that time. Smile Brigade is done. I mean, I guess it's possible that we could do a reunion show, but nobody would come, so I don't know why we would do that. But it's an interesting thought if we were ever in the same state or room together. To be honest, I don't see it happening, but you never know, I guess. I want to treat you guys to a Smile Brigade song. And this has been my third part of Seattle history. Thank you to Amy, who was also a big part of my musical history, and go back a couple episodes, and I went to Boston and played with her. I talked all about it, played a song called Offering of Love on that. And yeah, so I'm going to play you guys a song right now, and it's called Sing Song. And it's the first song Smile Brigade ever recorded, but we recorded it twice for that first little EP, first single, and then later for our final full length called Do You Come Here Often. It's a great song. This song has Peter on piano, Jeremy on drums, Leonardo on bass, myself on vocals and guitar, and enjoy. Go to the streaming services. That's the easiest way. Go listen to Smile Brigade. And listen to the last two things we did. It's Brianna, which is just pop heaven, and then Lovey Dovey, which is just an amazing song. I think that's the best song we ever did. So thanks, Peter, for that. That Peter sings on that one. Also check out the song Esperanto. Whatever. Maybe you'll like some of it. This is Sing Song from Smile Brigade. Thanks for listening, guys. We'll see you next week. Bye.